Are you a fan of vinyl records? Love collecting them and talking about them? Well, then you've come to the right place. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide with your host, Nate Goyer.
Hey everyone, it's Nate with yet another edition of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast by and for fans of vinyl records worldwide. Now, in today's episode, we're going to talk about a few things. Number one, I'm going to talk a little bit about this very peculiar recording slash record format from the early 50s called binaural records. It really is quite an odd one, so hopefully I've made it interesting enough. Please stay tuned for that. Also, I just arrived home, and I have this box with a record in it that someone sent me. So I'm going to open it up. I'm going to see what it is. I have no idea what it is, but I hope you guys will go on that journey with me. Before I get started, really quick, I wanted to say a big thank you to everyone that's out there who's been sharing the podcast, sending the links out, tagging me in Instagram, sending emails, giving different ideas for future episodes, and really, in short, being part of the success so far of this podcast. It really is impressive. It's encouraging, and I'm thankful and humbled by your support and your enthusiasm for what we're doing here on The Vinyl Guide. And if you're new to the show in its entirety, you can always reach out to me at nate@thevinylguide.com. That's N-A-T-E @thevinylguide.com. I enjoy reading your email and hearing your ideas and thoughts about the topics we talk about and potential future topics as well. And you could also tag me or check out my Instagram @vinylguide. There on my Instagram, I put pictures of all the different things we talk about here on the podcast for everyone to be able to see and get that kind of visual stimulation. And of course, we also do a call out to everyone. If they've got something related to one of the topics we're talking about, please tag us. I'd love to see what you got and, of course, learn more and add other pieces to the stories as we go. So email again, Nate, N-A-T-E, @thevinylguide.com or Instagram @vinylguide. Now, I'm going to start today's show by opening this package. Now, someone sent me this package. I just arrived home. This was sticking out of my mailbox. Thank God I came home early because it's a bit of a sunny day. I'd hate for this thing to get stuck in the sun. It is from a gentleman in St. Louis, Missouri. I'm not going to say their name just in case they don't want their name said. But I'm opening it as we speak. You can hear my knife and sharp cutlery happening. I'm hoping... this is packaged very well. So I'll give the guy's first name, Tom. Tom, if you're out there, you are very good at packaging records. So well done to you. I always thought that some of these people who package records really well really should make a video and put it on YouTube for how to package records, because there's so many people out there that are doing it wrong. Again, this is all in about to educate and make sure that we take care of our vinyl records. And oh my goodness, look at this. Oh, Tom, you are a godsend. Look at this. Oh, I hope, is this original? Oh my God. So I'm gonna describe for you what I have here. I'm holding here in my hands a record that is one of my personal holy grails. It's no longer a holy grail to me. It actually exists and I have it. So it is, wow. I'm very humbled and very very much looking forward to putting this on. It's a record by the Fortune Record Company. LP3002 is the matrix number. The artist, it's a split LP, John Lee Hooker and Big Maceo Merriweather. This is a record out of the 1950s. And out of Fortune Records, out of Detroit, Michigan, it's one of the gaps in my collection. Now, as many of you know, I'm a big fan of John Lee Hooker. I collect John Lee Hooker first USA pressings. I've got quite a few, however, I do have some gaps in my collection, and this is certainly one of them. The cover looks like it's in remarkable shape. Let me take a look at the record here. Ooh, it's a yellow label. Oh, this is like the original insert too. Oh my gosh, I think this needs a plastic sleeve here. Oh my God, it is gorgeous. Tom, you are awesome. And look at this runout groove. 3002 etched in the runout groove, side one. Any other text in here? Ah, this is beautiful. This is as good as a record this old can get. So, Tom from St. Louis, you are awesome. I'm going to post pictures of this on Instagram, and then I'm going to get your details. I'm going to send you a personal thank you note. This is huge. Thank you so much, Tom. I love getting these records in the mail, especially when it's one of these things to where I've been looking for it. I've been wanting it. And Tom from St. Louis, you made my day, dude. Thank you very much. A big vinyl guide huzzah goes out to Tom from St. Louis. Thanks, mate. So as I mentioned earlier, today I'm going to be talking about this very interesting slash niche slash short-lived record format out of the early 1950s called binaural records, B-I-N-A-U-R-A-L. And the reason I started down on this path is I bought a box of records a couple years ago, and inside that box was a very interesting black-labeled Atlantic record, and it was a record by an artist that I've never really heard of or I wasn't familiar with, and the name of the record is New Orleans Jazz by Wilbur de Paris and his Rampart Street Ramblers. Now it's a 12-inch record. It looks like any normal Atlantic Records issue of its time. It has the Black Atlantic label, which they used at the time. It also has verbiage around it, an Atlantic binaural record, and it was also the same song twice per side. So I started looking into it. I'll give you the matrix number, by the way. Atlantic Records, BIN1208. And after a bit of research, I found out that this was from a very early format in the vinyl industry, an early attempt at stereo. And this was perhaps one of the only mass-produced binaural records, this one from Atlantic Records. And by the way, I don't know how mass-produced it was, because I've only seen maybe one other copy, and that's after really searching hard. So I think I get a bit of a rare one here, but it's such an oddball format. So little is known about it kind of in the wide spectrum of record collectors and music fans worldwide. I don't think many people know about it. So I thought I'd dedicate today's podcast to talking about binaural records, give a bit of a history and some information about this, what I think someone very accurately described as the unicorn of vinyl records. Now, before I talk about these binaural records, the ones out of the early 50s, I want to talk a little bit about the current definition of the term binaural. Now, the current term binaural references a recording technique that tries to mimic the human hearing experience. And what do I mean by that? So when humans hear things, our eardrums are pointed horizontally. They're not faced in front of us. They're not kind of like our eyes where they see in front of us. They're faced outward to our left and to our right. We also have these ear canals and these bits of skin that help us gather the sound waves from around us and help us triangulate where a sound is coming from. So if somebody is walking circles around us, our hearing is keen enough to be able to tell whether they are slightly over our left shoulder or in front of our right shoulder, even with our eyes closed. Now, in short, that's the human experience of hearing. And if you look up binaural recording right now, it's a format, it's a process for recording sound in that fashion, to where you have two microphones that are placed exactly the width of the average human head, facing outwards, often complete with the same constraints of a human skin, the human ear, the little kind of bits of skin, that sort of thing. They really try to mimic what the human physical hearing experience is like. And that's how they mic things. And the theory being that if that's how they place the microphones and there is a band playing with, say, trombones on the left and saxophones on the right, that you will hear that natural separation, just like a human would, just like if you were in the same room. Now, it gets a bit weirder, simply because when studios go to make binaural recordings, they don't just place microphones in that position. Quite often they use an actual dummy head, a mannequin, that they retrofitted with these microphones to recreate it. So I can only imagine a musician who spent their entire life cultivating their art having to play a session facing a dummy's head with microphones in it. So it must be very odd, but that's the way they've chosen to do it, to best mimic the human hearing experience. Now, recording binaurally has remained a bit of a niche activity. It's never really become that widespread. I think probably the closest it came, at least in my lifetime, is Lou Reed. Lou Reed got into binaural recording for a brief period of time. I believe his Street Hassle album was recorded binaurally. He's got a couple other things. He's got a live album. I think it's Take No Prisoners that's recorded binaurally, and some of the Bells. So there are artists that have embraced it here and there. And by and large, the people who do binaural recordings now, they're not major artists. They're people that are experimenting with the format and find some value in it. Not judging them, but it's certainly not something that is in high common practice right now. Now, we should talk about the limitations of binaural recording. First off, you have to record everything at once. When musicians go to record an album, they use a multi-track recorder. They start with the drums and the bass, maybe some guitar tracks. Then they go back and they overdub other guitars and guitar solos, and they start layering things on top of one another. Then the vocals come, sound effects come, then they start panning stuff back and forth to make the sounds go from left to right. They add sound effects, all sorts of different things. It's like making a very big complicated sandwich, right? Many different layers involved. Well, with binaural recording, it has to be all at once. The band has to play everything exactly as it's going to appear in the final recording at that one time. If you think about it, the human head can't do overdubs. It has to be, if they're going to stick with the ethos, the purity of binaural recording, well, then everything has to be recorded all at once, so no overdubs or anything. The second limitation of binaural recording is really playback focused. The nature of a binaural recording is really meant for the human ears to be very close to the speakers, to be very involved. If you put a binaural recording on a normal stereo system, a lot of that subtlety will get lost. So binaural recordings, largely the playback really should be in headphones. If it's not, you're missing out on a significant portion of the reason why they recorded it binaurally in the first place. And the third limitation to binaural recordings, well, and again, I'm just kind of assuming this, musicians must feel awfully silly playing to a dummy head with microphones sticking out of the ears. So now that we've covered kind of the modern definition of binaural recording, let's talk about the binaural recording format of the early 50s. The story of binaural recording really begins, and in some ways ends, with its inventor, a guy named Emery Cook. Now, Emery Cook, he was an inventor, he was an audiophile, he was an engineer. He was from the US, he studied in MIT in the 1930s, he went on to Columbia, not the record company, the college. And then he went into industry working, he was an engineer, like I said, and he was working with some of the advanced technologies of the day. He started his career looking after radar installations, and then started getting involved in magnetic tape, which was quite the cutting edge at the time. While working with magnetic tape, that he took a very keen interest in recording audio and how magnetic tape captured this information, to the point that he started doing a lot of recordings on his own, trying to maximize the recording experience for the listener. Now, Emery Cook got so good, so proficient at making quality recordings that at an audio fair in 1951, he demonstrated the sound, the recorded sound of trains, and was so popular, it afforded him an audience with High Fidelity magazine, which was just beginning at the time. Now, High Fidelity magazine gave Emery Cook space to be able to talk and pontificate about his thoughts on the current state of audio recording. And in 1952, he gave a bit of a dissertation on the limitations of mono recording. And he introduced what was then called the binaural concept. Now, when we think about binaural, it is effectively two-channel synchronized mono, not stereo. And there's a subtle difference here. When we listen to a stereo recording, we have a left and a right channel. The way a record comes together. If you think about a record, and probably a very easy way to illustrate this is for everyone to make a V with their fingers. Take your index and your middle finger, make a V. Now, that V is like a record groove. One side of that V is the left channel, and the other side is the right channel. And when the stylus sticks in the middle of that groove, and when it travels along that groove, the styluses of today are machined small enough and fine enough to be able to pick up right channel and left channel at the same exact time from the same exact groove. That's how stereo works inside a record groove. Now, the stereo concept had been patented in 1933 by EMI. However, the problem being is the machinery and the manufacturing process at the time wasn't sophisticated enough to do it in any sort of mass production. So we were still a good 10 years or more away from having a really refined stereo process. So Emery Cook put forth the concept of binaural recording, again, which is two-channel synchronized mono. Now, let's talk about how binaural records worked. The concept of binaural records is, well, rather simple. Now, if you take a 12-inch record, which I'm sure everyone owns, think about it as if one side of that record had two long songs on that single side. So essentially, you would see one break in the middle. You would have one long song that started at the very beginning, the edge of the disc, and the second song would start somewhere halfway through. The way binaural records worked, rather than having two separate songs, it was the same song, only the outer rim had the left channel and the inner rim had the right channel. So effectively, if you were to play a binaural record, just like the Atlantic one that I have here, on a standard sound system today, you would hear the same song twice. First go around, you'd hear the left channel. Second go around, you'd hear the right channel. And with all those subtle differences, they needed to have some equipment to be able to play it. So the binaural concept, or the patents, the ideas that Emery Cook put together, the left channel and then the right channel, both played simultaneously with two cartridges, two styluses on the record at the same time. That required a tone arm with a forked head that was exactly 1 11/16 of an inch apart. With that sort of tone arm, two cartridges and two needles, a phonograph could play a binaural record. Again, two styluses on the record at the same time, one delivering left channel, one delivering right channel. Now, if you want to see one of these in action, it's pretty cool. Just do a little bit of Googling. There's a company called Livingston that made a dual head tone arm back in the early 50s for these binaural recordings. There's a guy on YouTube that has a video. He's restored one of these machines to play a binaural record, and it looks pretty bizarre, but just do a Google search of binaural Livingston record, and I'm sure it'll come up as one of the first links. Now, obviously, I've described this binaural process. It's fairly complicated. I'm sure some of you are already thinking about some of the limitations of this format. And let's talk about those. First limitation, I mean, very clearly, if you're using the record, half of it to do left channel, half of it to do right channel, essentially you're cutting the recording time in half. Rather than having 24 minutes per side, you're having maybe 10 or 12, give or take kind of the leading grooves on each side. So immediately your 12-inch record becomes about 10 minutes per side. Limitation number two, really the equipment. If you're an audiophile and you want to play binaural records, you had to pretty much replace every step in your audio chain, starting with the tone arm and the cartridges. You'd then have to change out your preamp to a preamp that would read left and right from this binaural format. And you also had to think about not only your speakers, because a lot of mono systems at the time only had single speakers, but lastly, your records. There really weren't a whole lot of records available, which is really the third and major limitation of binaural recordings. So Emery Cook decided to start a record company, which he aptly called Cook Records. Now, Cook Records weren't all about binaural recordings. If you do a search on Discogs for Cook Records, you'll see a lot of recordings that were not in the binaural format. But His aim was to create enough content for binaural recording audio enthusiasts to be able to keep his format, his patents, his designs going. Now that's no small feat, because essentially Emery Cook had to cater to just about anyone who had a binaural system. And people who were audiophiles weren't all into just jazz, or they weren't all just into classical music. They were into all sorts of different things. So Emery Cook really had to cater to a lot of people. And I'm sure you've all heard the phrase, if you try to make everyone happy, you'll make no one happy. And that's essentially what happened here. However, it's not like he didn't give it a good old college try, though. He recorded a lot of music, European music, American music. He recorded a lot of Caribbean music. About 25% of the 140 records that were created on Cook Records were Caribbean music or Caribbean in nature. Not sure why, but if you had a binaural audio system at home and you like Caribbean music, man, were you in business. Cook also created a lot of environmental recordings. So he would record rainstorms and trains and different things in the environment that would show off the binaural aspect, the left and right channel benefits of a binaural system. Cook also started getting other record companies involved, to limited success. There were a few other companies who started creating binaural records. And this Atlantic record that I have that I started talking about is a primary example of it. Atlantic Records thought they'd give it a go and allowed Wilbur D. Perry and his Rampart Street Ramblers the ability to record binaurally. Now, by looking at the record, and I'll go ahead and post these pictures in Instagram, on the back there are pictures of the musicians standing around two microphones that are, well, about 10 inches apart to be able to make the separation. You'll see the trombone on one side, the banjo on the other. So they really did want to have a stereo-esque field of sound. Now, I haven't heard this particular album in stereo format yet. Obviously, I don't have a binaural record player. I suppose I could record each channel and then put them together in some sort of Pro Tools type program. Candidly, I don't have the time. There's quite an extensive description on the recording process on the back of this record. Again, I'll go ahead and post all this in Instagram at Vinyl Guide. This was an example of one of the partner record companies that Emery Cook made to help create binaural recordings in the 50s. Now, as you can imagine, despite Emery Cook's best intentions at creating a binaural experience for record lovers around the world, the binaural experience was not meant to be, and there were some general performance issues that really accelerated the obsolescence of this format. First off, dual tone arms. There were two tone arms, which effectively meant that there was twice as much weight on the record. There was also multiple cartridges and styluses to change. So you have two styluses playing at the same time, the same amount. Your total cost of ownership doubles because you had to replace them twice as frequently. There were also challenges with skips and warps. So if you had a warped edge on one of the channels, but not on the inner channel, the two needles would not synchronize, and then you would get a very poor experience of non-synchronized recordings, which some people refer to as noise. So the record had to be absolutely 100%. Any sort of skips or warps completely ruined the experience and negated the whole concept of binaural records. Thirdly was the content. Again, lots of Caribbean music. If you like Caribbean music, well, hey, this could be right up your alley. But there wasn't a whole lot of content. There wasn't a lot of jazz. There wasn't a lot of, at least enough to satiate the people who really enjoyed their genres of music. So it was a bit of a toy, but nothing that anyone really invested heavily in because they couldn't connect to it. There were also issues with manufacturing. To be able to make a binaural record, the master, you actually had to have a dual head record cutter, which they were able to retrofit, but again, this wasn't common. This was more expensive to be able to do, and in the end, drove up the cost of a binaural record beyond what people were prepared to pay. Now, in the end, as we all know, stereo ended up coming into the market. And once manufacturers were able to machine equipment small enough, fine enough to be able to do left and right channel into a single groove, well, the fate of binaural records was sealed. However, Cook himself was not forgotten. In fact, he was entered into the Audio Engineering Society's Hall of Fame within his lifetime. Many of his records are still considered superior quality, very high dynamic range. And in 1990, Emery Cook and his wife Martha ended up donating all their master tapes, all their patents, all their papers to the Smithsonian. All of his research is still there as part of the historical record. And that is the story of the strange unicorn of vinyl. It was a vision. Of course, the vision must be applauded. Quite honestly, not everyone is Steve Jobs, but he really gave it a good go. And to that, we must give Emery Cook a vinyl guide. Huzzah! For all your efforts and all your tenacity in making audio a more pleasurable experience for all. So that's our story of Emery Cook and the binaural experiment of the early 50s. Again, fascinating story, at least to me. I hope you guys enjoyed it. I'm going to be posting some pictures up on Instagram, at Vinyl Guide. And again, always keen to hear your stories. If you have something or another piece of the puzzle to add to this, or pictures of what you have, if you have any binaural equipment, I'd love to see it, love to hear more about it. Give me an email, Nate, N-A-T-E, at thevinylguide.com. That's all for today's episode. Tom from St. Louis, thank you so much, mate. I'm going to be putting on this John Lee Hooker record right now. Again, thanks everyone. Until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of The Vinyl Guide, the one-stop shop for vinyl fans, with your host, Nate Goyer. Check them out online at thevinylguide.com or on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. We'll catch you next time.